A warm Christian greeting to each of you this evening. May the Lord quiet our hearts and be able to hear what He's saying. So before I get into the actual Mennonite Nazi story, I said last night that the job of a teacher is to work himself out of a job. You're going to forget most of the stuff I say. But if I can recommend some books to you, you take resources home with you, then you can, the path forward is unlimited. So, these books will all be placed on a table right inside the door, and these can be purchased from Arcturus. I got these from Arcturus, so you can't pay for them tonight, and you probably ought to pay everything tomorrow night. But if you are age 21 and you don't have one of these, you owe yourself this. This is the best concise statement of what Anabaptist vision is. This was given as a historical address in 1943, and it stood the test of time. It's only 36 pages, but it's a very concise, excellent statement. Cathedrals, castles, and caves. This tells the story of what led to the Reformation and what is behind or why Anabaptism took hold. So this is up to the Reformation. It doesn't really discuss the Reformation. Cathedrals, castles, and caves. Okay, there's two books that I recommend for introductory. This is one of them. Introduction to Mennonite History by Cornelius Dick. This is the third edition. This is the three branches. The Dutch, Prussia, Russia side of things. The Swiss Brethren side of things, which is you group, you people sitting here, including myself, and the Hutterites. This traces all three from the beginning up to the present. There's another companion book to this that I don't have a copy. Arcturus did not have this. It's called Smith's Story of the Mennonites, 5th edition. I like that one even better than this. It's thicker. But this one has pictures. And so you can take a look at those. And if you can't buy them through Arcturus, you can always go online and get these things. So there's no excuse for us in the day and the technology that we have, they are available. And so it's just a matter of investing both a little bit of money and maybe more time. Tim Price is a friend of mine, and he works with us. This is Anabaptism at 500. The story that I'm going to give you tonight is in this book. It's written. It's a transcribed. He gets things transcribed. This was the conference in Arthur, Illinois. It does not just have what I have here tonight. It has a bunch of other things as well. So you can take a look and see what this book has. Okay, so I referenced this book last night, The Labyrinth of the World and Paradise of the Heart, the very best teaching on the two kingdom doctrine that I know of. It's an allegory form. It's a little step up. It's like you'd probably be better if you were in your upper teens. This is written by John Amos Comenius, the inventor of children's books, picture children's books. Just an excellent. Take a look at this if you don't have one. Okay, I'm not even going to refer to this, but up from the rubble is the story of Berlin and Peter and Alfreda Dick after World War II. The epic rescue of thousands of war-ravaged Mennonite refugees. Some of you might have this one in your library already. I'm going to make a reference to this book tonight, A Place for Ruth. It's the story. You can see that. It's that thick. I'm just going to touch on the story. I gave a presentation like this at Grantsville, Maryland, and I didn't know about the story. And somebody there says, you need to go visit Ruth Yoder. So I went to visit Ruth Yoder, and she has a story. Her dad was an SS man, and eventually, this book was written as her story. Arcturus has a catalog. It's that thick. They're coming tomorrow night, and if you can't find on the table, you can find it in here. And we have a bunch of these catalogs out there on that table, and there's also Ardent Youth. How many of you already get Ardent Youth? None of you. Oh, okay, it's a free copy of Ardent Youth along with the catalog. They'll be on the tables back there also. Okay, so this book, The Neo-Nazi Story. What I'm going to give you tonight is the reasons why and how this happened that Anabaptists became Nazis and supporter of the Nazi cause. Okay, this book is not the same as what I'm going to be talking to you. This is the consequences. 250 pages, and all this is a student resource. You have pictures in here, and you have text in here, but you have all kinds of places you can do further study. Okay, so this is just a tool in your hands. This is the consequences as they played out in Germany. Just on the front cover here, this is Heinrich Himmler talking to that Mennonite doctor, John Clausen, that you see in white there. After the war was over, John Clausen was executed for war crimes. His job was to kill handicapped children. He was a Mennonite who killed handicapped children. So these will, Arcturus handles these, and you can purchase them from Arcturus. All right, without further ado, let's turn these lights off and get started here. So we raise the question, Mennonite Nazi, why? How does it happen that people who have a background as martyrs become Nazis, murderers? How does that happen? There's a book that I don't have here tonight called Mennonite German Soldier. Arcturus does not carry this book, but you can easily buy it. It's still in print. It tells the story of how the Mennonites in Germany spent 100 years losing their non-resistance. Just, of course, a little bit of the time. And so then they were willing and ready to become Nazis, and I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, so I have to get finished here in a decent amount of time, and I cannot linger. I would love, if we were a small class of high school students, we would just stop and just talk about this. So let me introduce this, at least. Memory is a conscious work of interpretation, marked as much by deletion as by selection. How a community remembers its past is the single most important element in determining its future. Okay, somebody was smart last night. If you want to remember some of these things, you can take pictures of what you have here. Because what I have right here is not in this book. All I did with this book is just simply, I discovered things here and there and everywhere and put them together in this book. But this is not in here. This is a general historical truth. How a community remembers its past is the single most important element in determining its future. Think of the gun analogy I gave last night. Okay, number one on that circle, right above the chart one, that's us. That's the Swiss Brethren. Now, we are standing here tonight because our ancestors migrated to America at various times. My ancestors came in the 1700s. You folks' ancestors came 100 years later in the 1800s, but you came to America. But not all of your relatives or my relatives came to America. Some Swiss Brethren stayed in Europe. In fact, the last Amishman died in Europe in 1939. And once he died, there were no more Amish in Europe. When you folks came across, you came as Amish. There was no such thing as Old Order Amish. And there were Diener Versammlungs from 1868, I think, to, or 1862 to 1878. There's a period of time where Amish people, Amish leaders got together, and that's what they called the sorting out. Two-thirds of the Amish became change-minded Amish and joined Mennonite conferences like us. One-third did not join the conference. It's that one-third who became known as Old Order Amish. That was 3,000 people. Two-thirds became a part of the Mennonites and are gone today. That original 3,000 has now become approximately 400,000. Okay. Number one has to do with the people who stayed in Europe. I think I can say, I know it's true for the Mennonite side of things, but I think it's true also for the Amish side of things, that the heart and soul of both Mennonites and Amish came across the Atlantic to America. Now, anytime people move, there are people who stay. Okay, the thing that I want to impress on us tonight, the story I'm going to give you about number 1, 2, and 8 are the people who stayed. You'll notice that number 2, which is the Dutch Mennonites, Menno Simons kind, some of them went to America, but most of them, as they were persecuted, went east to number 8, which is Prussia. Number 8, around 1700, was the largest Mennonite population in the world at one time. Eventually, many of those people went on to number 10, which is Kortytsa and Miloshna and the other daughter colonies in Ukraine. Some of them went to Samara and Amtrak. You can see the line there, too. So what I'm going to be talking about tonight is 1, 2, and 8. Not talking about the rest. Now, number 10 is going to come into the picture tonight. History is not the facts of the past. It's impossible for a historian to write without his own perspective, his own biases coming through. We like to think history is just the facts, but somebody decides which facts. History is the written record of the past. The written record is selective. The author chooses what to include or what to omit. If you get it included, number 2, it's either slanted from the author's point of view, being sanitized, portraying only the best about the subject, or B, being demonized, portraying the worst about the subject. So anything you read in history is always slanted. Just remember that. One way or the other, and we need to read with discernment. Okay, I would like a little feedback right here from the group. If you had these three words, American, Mennonite, and Christian, how would you put them together? Would you put it Mennonite, Christian, American? Think about yourself. Are you a Mennonite, Christian, American? Or are you a Christian, American, Mennonite? Or are you an American, Mennonite, Christian? Someone brave enough, say which way you feel about yourself. You're number 2, a Christian, American, Mennonite. Okay, you've got one. Everybody feel comfortable with that? Is that how you would? There's a man shaking, nodding, shaking his head. Okay, what would you say? Christian, Mennonite, American. So number 1, just Christian and Mennonite switched. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Now we have 2 ideas. One more. Yes. Impossible. Impossible. Because you can't be a Christian without some kind of theological system. That's why it's impossible. Everybody has a belief system of some kind. Okay, so it's either the Catholic Orthodox version or some kind of Protestant version or an Anabaptist. There are only 3 of those possibilities. Okay, that's a big subject. I don't want to go astray there. Okay, so in school, we teach grammar that the noun is the most important word, carries the most weight, and adjectives are weaker. So the only proper grammatical, at least I hope this is true for you and I, it's only number 3 up here that we should consider. And it doesn't matter if we're an American Mennonite Christian or a Mennonite American Christian, but just so Christian is first. And I think that's what this brother is getting at. He wants to make sure Christian is first. The story I'm going to give you tonight is a group is the story of a people who decided they want to be German first, not Christian first. You see, ideas have consequences. Biblically, we say sowing, given time, produces some kind of reaping. Scientifically, we say cause, given time, produces an effect. But ideas have consequences. It matters what you and I think, because what we think, so are we. And what we are generates our actions. All right, we could park and talk about that for a while. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. This gift makes it possible for a given age, in the midst of its blithe optimism, to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. Wow, that's worth pondering. Some people say, well, why study history? I mean, I don't live in the past. I live right now. Let's just talk about right now, and we'll figure out what we ought to do right now. Can't do that. Doesn't work that way. We have a whole lot of baggage and information and culture and training in our background. You cannot just be free to make choices. Everything in our background is there to help us think about one way or the other. Anyone who contemplates history cannot help but notice how the gift of blessed forgetfulness is given to virtually every generation in the unrolling years of history. That includes us today in 2026. This gift makes it possible for a given age, in the midst of its blithe optimism, everything will turn out all right, blithe optimism, to repeat the fatal mistakes of a previous generation with hardly a pang of remorse or fear. I could talk about this for a while. I just will not. Except I want you to notice that the bottom of this slide, it says, this is a quote from 7 men who rule the world from their graves. Some of you might have that book at home. It's a worthwhile book. Not every one of my slides has a reference. I wished all of them, I would have put one with every one of them, but I'm sorry, I just don't have it for every one. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Yet those who do study history are doomed to stand by helplessly while everyone else repeats it. We can't escape. So why this topic? Those who don't know the past are condemned to repeat it. So why did this Mennonite Nazi story happen? The very first statement there is the first point of the Anabaptist vision. Jesus Christ, through the Holy Scriptures, is the ultimate authority. In this case, Jesus Christ, through the Holy Scriptures, was no longer the ultimate authority. Now, every one of us have an ultimate authority. And it would be fun if we were all high school students to talk about that for a while. But there is something that drives every one of us. It's the ultimate authority, and we all have one. It's impossible not to. In this particular case, the pride in being German replaced the Christ-centered Anabaptist identity. And so we talked about this last night a little bit. The Roman Catholic and the Protestant version of state and church each functions in its own sphere while remaining organically connected. We call that state church. Whereas for Anabaptist people, we have the two kingdom doctrine, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of this world, with no organic connection. The church and the state function in completely different spheres with completely different responsibilities. We talked about that last night in tracing the history of this two kingdom doctrine. I gave this presentation at Shipshewana about a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago. And somehow this man, who's Arnold Neufeld Fast, he's a Mennonite historian in Canada, he heard about this. And he wrote to Tim Price, and Tim Price passed this on to me. And here's what he says. Thousands of Mennonites like me in Canada have inherited this story. I trust the presentations will help the audience become more alert about how these shifts can happen in our congregations, no matter how pious, how educated, how aligned with and informed by the Anabaptist story. When a people enters the fog, much becomes confused with dangerous consequences, and can happen again. The generation of my grandmother, who was born in 1903, that survived Stalin and Hitler, they were largely broken and unable and without the skill set to work through much of this. But they grew up in a Mennonite colony or a Mennonite village. My mother's generation, she was born in 1937. The children, or her older brothers, actually soldiers, well, they have begun to speak. They have begun to tell the stories and are able to tell some of the dark sides. My generation, this man was born in 1964, in Canada, with higher education, bilingual, with strong memories of our surviving grandmothers, we're the generation who is asking hard questions about what really happened. Pause. This story is so awful that after it happened, everybody just shut up. They didn't know how to deal with it. And the best way they knew to deal with it is not to say anything. It took from 1945, when World War II was over, until 1995 is a space of 50 years. It took 50 years for the Mennonites in Germany to finally come up with a written statement on this. How do you come to terms with the realization that you became a partner with one of the most evil regimes in human history? How do you process that? Okay. He says, even my mother says, don't tell people that my older brothers were Waffen-SS. But of course, that's the stuff we need to unpack in order to process the dysfunction in many of our congregations. My essays above are academic essays. My 87-year-old mother is old enough now that I can speak more freely and dig in deeply into this troubling story. We do not help ourselves by just shh. Don't talk about it. Put it under the rug. Don't talk about it. It's one of the worst things to do because it eventually will surface. This comes from Smith's story of the Mennonites. Since the days of their origin in Switzerland, that's us, the Swiss brethren, and the Netherlands, that's the Dutch Mennonites, the Mennonites have become a separate people because of their faith and status in the society wherever they went. Those that feared they would lose their identity, be this by compulsion or by gradual adjustment, moved on to countries where they were able to retain it. Now, I talked about that already. Consequently, by the time Hitler came to power, the Mennonites that had retained in numbers 1, 2, and 8 had surrendered much of this identity. It's one task to describe this, and that's what I'm going to do tonight. And another to go back and to trace all the steps of surrender of the original Anabaptist conception and testimony, as well as lift up the price that many were willing to pay to remain faithful to the Lord through the centuries. And I wish we could spend more time with that, but that's not where we're going tonight. Concerning basic Christian convictions, one can have them, one can lose them, and one can, by the grace of God, even regain them. But that is hard work. Mennonite nationalism, or Mennonite Nazis, is a contradiction in terms. Mennonites historically have been bound by faith, not blood. I was sitting at Brother Arlen's tonight around his supper table, and I just felt comfortable there. I don't know this family. They're not blood to me. But the faith was common, and immediately we could fellowship together. We are bound by faith, not by blood. I don't have any Amish background. Well, Hartzler, way back, but the Mennonite Nazi idea was bankrupt from the start. Those Mennonites who were ignorant of their story, along with those who regarded their story, who rejected their story, were duped into shameful behavior and were thrust into the ridicule of history. So by the mid-1700s, the Mennonites in Germany were losing their Anabaptist worldview. I've already talked about Mennonite German soldier. They spent 100 years losing their non-resistance one step at a time. So that by 1900, that's 125 years ago, they were ready to take up arms. And a bunch of Mennonites went to fight in World War I. 400 young men died Mennonite soldier deaths in World War I. But they had come to love the martial spirit of their times. Now, what do I mean by that? So Mennonites are known as quiet people. Gelassenheit is important to them. They don't say everything they know. But when you have martial music, military music, it makes boys want to step. And when you have smart uniforms that are exactly fitted, a young man feels like he has some energy, power, and identity if he's in one of those uniforms. And if he's handing a gun, he has power. And so the Mennonite boys got tired of their Gelassenheit, and they liked this martial music. They loved these uniforms, and they loved their guns. So the Prussian-German Mennonites were mostly assimilated in Prussia by the late 1800s and desired to partake of all the positive elements of being German and wanted to participate fully in German society. On the other hand, the Mennonites wanted to maintain the cultural and religious traditions that gave them a strong sense of group identity and a strong sense of their connection with their cherished history. One side, they wanted to identify with the Prussian spirit, the Prussian military spirit. On the other side is Anabaptism. You can't do both. They're diametrically opposed to each other. You have to make a choice, this or this. Since they didn't have a strong sense of their history and the present was glamorous, they came over here. And they wanted to identify with the Prussian. The Prussian Mennonites were familiar with the martyr's mirror, but they chose to believe that the past did not apply to the present. The martyr's stories were good for that day, but not applicable for the present day. Does that sound familiar in any way? The German Mennonites outgrew their Anabaptist forefathers, such as Menno Simons. Instead, they adopted the ideas of Julius Wellhausen, the German rationalist scholar, and Friedrich Schleiermacher, their higher criticism claimed that the Bible was a sublime collection of human documents. Human reason was to be trusted, not the supernatural claims of the Bible. So tomorrow night, we're going to talk about religious liberalism even more. So I guess I won't say anything more about religious liberalism, but that's what this is. It's a choice between Anabaptism and religious liberalism. Again, you can't do both. It's either this or that, because they're opposed to each other. A culture cannot lose its philosophic center without the most serious of consequences. Not just to the philosophy on which it was based, but to the whole superstructure of culture, and even each person's notion of who he or she is. Everything changes. And again, we could pause and talk about that as high school people. Can't do it tonight. What we are, our thinking, our ultimate authority makes so much difference. Ideas have consequences. And right now, it's impossible for us to be here as a human being without have a philosophic center, which is driving us. It's what made you come tonight. Okay, so if these Mennonites were interested in becoming a part of the Prussian culture was state church. And you can't have state church like Lutheran. Luther's idea of a true church is where the doctrine is correctly taught and the sacraments are correctly administrated. That's the definition of a church from a Lutheran background. Well, Lutherans, as I showed you earlier, state church is the order of the day. The church has this role, the state has this role, but they're together. Okay, so Anabaptists are completely two different, two kingdoms. Okay, so if the people who run the schools are state church, and these Mennonites want their young men to get seminary training so they can be good preachers, all they get taught is state church. With leadership from Lutheran and Baptist-trained pastors who encourage church-state cooperation, the Mennonites, one of the few Christian denominations founded on the theology of radical nonconformity and non-resistance, two kingdoms, were left without a substantial theological foundation for resisting Nazism. When they lost their two-kingdom principle, they became a special prey for Mennonite Nazi, to become Nazi in thought. So Anabaptists understand that we have an individual conscience. We understand we're going to answer to God someday for the things we've done in our body. No question. All of us believe that. So do Protestants. They say they believe that. But you notice Anabaptists have something else. It's a collective conscience. No man is in Christ apart from his brother. Like, what's your first name? Josh. Okay, so I don't know Josh. But I need Josh in the world. If I just have a God and I kind of things, oh, I just love you, Lord. I just love you, love you. God's not impressed with that. He says, if you love me, serve other people. I can tell this man I love you, I love you. I just feel warm and fuzzy in my heart because I see you, but I don't help you. Do I love you? No, I don't love you. Okay, so if Josh and I were working closely, he'd have to forgive me sometimes. I might have to forgive him too. And if he sorrows, then I need to cry with him. And if he rejoices, has a new baby, or one of his children get married, I rejoice with him. I live in the world with this man. My children go to school with his children. We need each other. That's called the collective. We have accountability to the group. God deals with us as a group, not just as us as individuals. There's a story that's being written about Allen County Christian Fellowship. And since I got here, I found out you already had two outreaches. And I just told Brother Arlen at a supper table tonight, there are so many places yet to do outreaches. Don't do another one here in northern Indiana. It's like, why? Mennonites are manure. You know that, don't you? Mennonites are like manure. You have them all in a pile, it just bleeds and stinks. Manure is meant to be spread out and turned under. I told them at the supper table, we first got to Texas. I had a bakery, and there's some girls working there, and people asked me, are you some kind of Mormons? They just assumed all these girls were my wives. They didn't know. Mennonites. Midianites. That's in the Bible, isn't it? I didn't know. This is a big subject. I better stop right there. And so, if we have Prussian Mennonites with a liberal, individualized God and I theology, plus conservative political views, that equals Mennonite German Nazis minus the two kingdom concept. And it was impotence against Satan and recognized by the Nazis. And again, we could park there and talk about that for a while. Now let's get more directly into the story. Adolf Hitler said in 1923, this is a quote, "The Jews are undoubtedly a race, but not human. They cannot be human in the sense of being an image of God. The Jews were considered a pestilence by the Nazis, a spiritual pestilence, worse than the Black Death. Why? They fought with ideas. Their power was everywhere. The only way to remove the plague was to eradicate it. If one Jewish family remained, it could infect the entire continent. That is why the Jews would need to be eliminated." 1924, Adolf Hitler wrote, "By their fruits ye shall know them. Puritans, Anabaptists, Jehovah's Witnesses, those are the juiciest ones. In each of them sits the Jewish maggot." Now, we could talk about this as to why he says that, but I don't want to get sidetracked here. Okay, so that's 1924. In 1928, this is 7 days after my dad was born, this quote was given. "We tolerate no one in our ranks who attacks the ideas of Christianity. Our movement is Christian." These are quotes from a book called Mennonites in Canada. One of the first tasks of the new regime, Hitler's regime, was a domestic cleanup, doing away with corruption, treason, immorality, and thievery. Germany would become well again, socially and morally, and that the old Prussian spirit of purity, honesty, sincerity, and uprightness would prevail again. The people were optimistic and happy. All were working. All old and young alike loved Hitler. There was a brother who was talking last night right up here. I forget his name. He said when Hitler came to power, the people felt like they could eat ice cream once again. So is that brother here? Give us the exact quote. Something about eating ice cream. Then once they came, they got work again, they could eat ice cream again. So Hitler was the savior, an economic savior for those people. This is also from Mennonites in Canada. "Adolf Hitler was the one Western nation that stood up bravely against the threat from the East." That's Russia. Russia now represented all the evils of the day, including atheism, modernism, immorality, and human exploitation. Hitler had proved himself the greater enemy of communism than the church. The Führer was sympathetic to Christianity. Why wouldn't we love a man like this? Why wouldn't we be loyal to him? Adolf Hitler says, "Today Christianity stands at the head of this country. I pledge that I will never tie myself to those who want to destroy Christianity. We want to fill our culture again with the Christian spirit. We want to burn out all the recent immoral development in literature, theater, the arts, and in the press. In short, we want to burn out the poison of immorality, which has entered into our whole life and culture as a result of liberal excess of the past few years. These are three separate quotes from the same book called The Burden of Guilt. On page 124, we have this quote. In his declaration of policy, Hitler was the wolf in sheep's clothing. He explained that the government aimed at creating conditions for a deeply felt and truly personal religion, that it placed the greatest value on friendly relations with the church, and the German nation wanted to live in peace with the world. On page 166, 22 pages later, in no field did Hitler disorient the minds as thoroughly as in his approach to the relations between Nazism and Christianity. Now, the Nazi version of Christianity is called positive Christianity. It was already on the party platform. Because of this, many people were induced to believe in all seriousness that Hitler had saved Christianity from red persecution or atheistic communism, and he would allow the free exercise of religion. Hitler further confirmed Christians in this belief by declaring that he was concerned only with the state and politics, not with the supernatural. But just two pages later, Hitler's real plans were well known to his inner circle, where he dropped all pretense. The churches may take command of the German in hereafter. The German nation, through its Führer, takes command of the German in this world. Hitler told Rauschning that he would completely stamp out Christianity in Germany. Wow! Speaks out of this side of his mouth and speaks out of this side of his mouth. That's dualism. That's Gnosticism. That's wrong. Very wrong. Do you know that you can still listen to him speak today? He speaks in German. He was an electrifying speaker. In 1924, a Mennonite West Prussian congregation wrote about the rise of Adolf Hitler. God gave our German people a Führer who knows how to unite our nation with God's strength. Our prayers go out to him. May God bless him and arm him with his strength, not only to become a leader toward unity, but also a leader for us and for our German people toward God and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Wow, what a statement. That's 1924. In 1933, which is 9 years later, the German Mennonites wrote this in a letter to Adolf Hitler. The Conference of East and West Prussian Mennonites meeting today in Tegenhagen in the Free State of Danzig is grateful for the great uplift which God has given our people through your strength of will, and also pledges its enthusiastic willingness to cooperate with the building of our fatherland with the strength of the gospel true to the motto of our fathers, "On other ground can no man lay a foundation than Jesus Christ." That last statement there, "On other ground can no man lay than a foundation than Jesus Christ," was Menno Simon's favorite verse, 1 Corinthians 3:11. They're writing this to Adolf Hitler. And Adolf Hitler writes back, and this is what he says. "The content of your letter reveals true loyalty to me and your readiness for the cooperation with the construction of the German Reich, and I extend my sincere thanks." The German people commonly believe that the Jews were responsible for the German loss of World War I. Okay, we can't go into that. The Treaty of Versailles unfairly held Germany responsible for large war reparations or paying for the damages of war. And it's true, the Treaty of Versailles, which ended World War I, was very unfair to Germany. No question. And it actually helped bring on World War II. But it not only angered the Germans, but it angered Adolf Hitler himself. Thus, Hitler could portray the Germans as the victims and the Jews as the victimizers. The Jews would need to be dealt with. I have another PowerPoint on propaganda. The Nazis were masters of propaganda. And I'm thinking right now of one of the propaganda posters. It has a figure stepping on somebody. He's face down. He's stepping on his back. And the man on the ground is a German. And the Jews are tramping on the Germans. Is that true? The answer is no. It was the reverse. But if you tell people lies long enough, they will believe that. They will believe the lie. I'm getting ahead of myself again. The stated German rationale, the moral imperative as to why the Jews need to be eradicated. Now, this is by Joseph Goebbels, the master of, he was the head of the propaganda ministry. He was a master propagandist. He says, the Jew is the primordial evil in the world, completely satanic and devilish. We are now fighting this fight against him until his ultimate end. This is why this fight has become so hard and so ruthless. The Jew wants our blood and the blood of our children. And we want his destruction in Europe. In between, there is no compromise. If the Jew wins, then all who are of German blood will be destroyed, sterilized, tortured to death, slaughtered. If we win, then Judaism will, according to the words of the Fuhrer, be eradicated from the world. You can't have it both ways. Hitler said, Providence has ordained that I should be the greatest liberator of humanity. I am freeing man from the restraints of an intelligence that has taken charge from the dirty and degraded self-mortifications of a false vision called conscience and morality. The Ten Commandments have lost their validity. Conscience is a blemish, like circumcision. By fighting off the Jews, I am doing the Lord's work. Today I believe that I am acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator. That is written in his book, Mein Kampf. When he was sitting in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf, which means my struggle. This is a quote from that book. Adolf Hitler promoted the idea of social Darwinism. The strong survive, the weak die off because they lose in the competition. Christianity and its notion of charity should be replaced by the ethic of strength over weakness. Peace, humility, and meekness were weakness. And this is Friedrich Nietzsche. He's the one who came up with the statement, God is dead and we have killed him. This is Adolf Hitler writing to Hermann Rauschning. We must free ourselves of all sentimentality and become hard. When I give the order for war one day, I shall not worry about 10 million young men whom I thus send to their death. What impresses is cruelty. Cruelty and brute force. If someone is so effeminate that he cannot endure seeing someone writhe in pain beside him, he must join a monastery, not my party comrades. History will recognize our movement as the great battle for humanity's liberation, a liberation from the curse of Mount Sinai. God is a tyrant who orders one to do the very things one doesn't like. I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel. So, we have Mennonite principles, two kingdoms, separation from the world, conform only to the will of God, swearing no oath to an earthly ruler, Maintaining Non-Resistance, and Nazi Principles, which are demanding conformity to Nazism, demanding loyalty through an oath. They're going to subdue the world forcibly in Hitler's name. You can't do both. You have to make a choice. It's either this or that. The desire to remain in Prussia. Think, the people who did not move. The desire to remain in Prussia led the Mennonites into a pattern of compromise. Now, this is a Lutheran pastor, Pastor Lufthauser, who said this. Now, this is hard to believe. But he says, Christ has come to us through Adolf Hitler. We have only one task, to be German, not Christian. Hitler himself said, the heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity, an invention of the Jews. Now, remember, he just said a few slides back, our movement is thoroughly Christian. And now he says the heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was Christianity. You cannot speak out of both sides of your mouth. And so, right straight out in 1933, he says, one is either a German or a Christian. You can't be both. Now, one honest German Mennonite by the name of Joseph Gingrich notes in 1934, and this man has disappeared from history. We don't know his end. We don't know the rest of his story. But he had his head screwed on straight when he said this: the danger is great because we have become faint-hearted and unaccustomed to struggle after a long period of religious peace and freedom, and because we quite naturally bristle at recognizing a danger that will shoo us out of our compliant contentedness, since it may well shatter our religious as well as our economic well-being. Wow, this man was perceptive. Think about strong men make good times. Good times create soft men. Soft men create hard times. And so on. We shared that last night. He could see that. So, Mennonites talked, and then they wrote. So in 1934, the German Mennonite Conference eliminated a non-resistant position from its written confession of faith. Now they're saying it both orally and in print. 1934. This is a quote from Chosen Nation. And by the way, Arcturus Books does not have Chosen Nation. You can buy that. That's a book that has just recently been written by Ben Goosen. And I think the copyright is just real recent, like 2018. And then there's another book called European Mennonites and the Holocaust. You can buy this at the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And I have some quotes from that book as well. But I don't think that the Arcturus Books are going to bring either one of those. But you can easily buy these because they're in print right now. But this is from Chosen Nation. Okay, after the Mennonites eliminated non-resistance from its confession of faith, Mennonite leaders sought to reassure themselves, the government, and the wider public that their pacifism was dead and buried. Through the Constitution of the Union of German Mennonite Congregation, the principle of non-resistance has been fully abandoned. Today, the German Mennonites perform military duties without any qualifications. Many Mennonites from the Reich voluntarily joined the army. And we'll have more to say about that later. So in 1935, the German Mennonites had adopted the premise of one people, one state, one leader. They had completely identified themselves with the German people. No longer two kingdoms. This is an actual picture of a Prussian Mennonite house with a chest. And this brown shirt uniform belonged to the owner of that house and I guess was kept in that chest. Okay, we've talked about the philosophic center. Something changes. Okay, so the definition of neighbor changes. So here's the new definition of neighbor if you're a Nazi. One with whom one shares one's being, in whom your blood also flows, a soul of one's soul. One's people is the area in which a Christian extends love. We are part of the German people. The German is our neighbor to whom we declare our love and give our strength. Where's the Good Samaritan concept? It's gone completely. We have no obligation to Samaritans now. Only Germans are our neighbors. And so, German Mennonites would only help Jews if it did not put their own lives in jeopardy. How many of you have read Corrie ten Boom's book, The Hiding Place? Raise your hands. Many of you. So Corrie ten Boom was willing to help Jews, but Mennonites were not. So this couple right here is a poor picture. I think it's the lady who says this in answer to the question why German Mennonites did not help Jews when they had the opportunity. She said, if you were seen talking to a Jew, then the Germans would treat you like a Jew. Mennonites did not help Jews or hide Jews. It was too dangerous to be associated with Jews. Somehow, Corrie ten Boom didn't think that. German Mennonites repeatedly hailed Adolf Hitler as the liberating savior from communism. When Stalin came to power after Lenin died, Stalin had his purges. And he caused the Holodomor to occur, the forced starvation of the Russian people. You might have read about that. And whenever that starvation happened, the German Mennonites would send humanitarian aid to their relatives in Russia. But beginning in 1935, the Nazis said, stop it. They blocked all German Mennonite financial assistance to their persecuted brothers and sisters in the Soviet Union. And since they had chosen Hitler and Nazism, they said, yes, sir. And they stopped sending aid to the Russian relatives. They have a new Lord now. Okay, so let me go ahead to this picture first. The Rhineland. I don't know if that means anything to you, so we're going to go to the next picture. You see that blue line? The Treaty of Versailles said the German soldiers were not permitted to be closer than 40 miles east of the Rhine and were forbidden west of the line of the Rhine. Well, on March 7, 1936, in defiance of the treaty, the German army moved into the Rhineland. Now back here. Oh, I'm sorry. By occupying the Rhineland in 1936 in defiance of treaty, Hitler had taken a huge gamble and won. Hitler succeeds at everything, people said. Not long later, Hitler won 98.8% of the vote in an election. Triumph upon triumph, gloated Goebbels, the soon-to-be Nazi propaganda minister. We did not dare hope for this in our wildest dreams. We were all stunned. The Führer was very still and said nothing. He only laid his hand on my shoulder, and there were tears in his eyes. Later that year at the Nuremberg Party Conference, Hitler proclaimed, "It is the miracle of our age that you found me among so many millions, and that I found you is Germany's great fortune." Now, that Palatinate, did you see that yellow part of that map? That's where we used to live. These, my people, your people were in France. On the France side, down on the bottom left corner is Alsace. That's where you people were. Some of your people were just a little further north, but most of you people, I think, came from further south there. Okay, so now we're going to think about the Rhineland. It was taken from Germany as a part of the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. The Rhineland is the industrial heartland of Germany, as is the Saarland along the Rhine River. The southern part of this region hosted Anabaptist refugees from Switzerland many years earlier. It's the same area where we used to live. at least my kind of people. Okay, so Ambrose of Milan made this quote. He who knows evil is being done and does nothing to stop it is guilty with the evildoer. This is not an Anabaptist. He was a church leader. He lived around 400 AD. But he says this, and this is a truth. This applies in 2026 as well as it applied throughout the church age. He who knows evil is being done and does nothing to stop it is guilty with the evildoer. And so, to remain silent and indifferent is the greatest sin of all. I want the students that I take to Washington, D.C. every year to read Elie Wiesel's book called Night. How many of you here read Night already? It's a little thin book. One person. Do you know the scripture says, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. That's part of our job. That's part of being salt and light in 2026 in our communities. Expose evil. You will be hated for it. I will be hated for it. People don't like to be exposed, but they do evil. And they will do things to get back at you. By 1938, this is a year before World War II started, an overwhelming majority of Mennonite elders and ministers in West Prussia and Danzig were members of the Nazi Party. Did you get that? Elders and ministers were members of the Nazi Party. And as party members, they wear the swastika on their chest with pride and joy. Now, that's a quote from Benjamin Unruh. He was the official representative of Russian Mennonites in Germany. He was born in Russia, but he's of the same people group. That comes as a quote from European Mennonites in the Holocaust. Here's his picture. This is what he looked like. Heinrich Himmler, the man on the front cover of this Mennonite Nazi story, said of Benjamin Unruh, "You are the Moses of the Russian Mennonites." This man, Benjamin Unruh, was a towering German Mennonite mover and shaker of enormous influence. The Mennonites just trusted this man. Previously in Russia, in 1918, this is way back, with Brother Benjamin Unruh in the lead, there were those who considered our non-resistance as a mere tradition and pointed out how Abraham of old rescued Lot militarily, how David had killed the giant Goliath, Samson the Philistines, etc. Unruh says, "This is the first Selbstschutz sermon that I had heard." Really? With such arguments, Unruh and others sought to move Russian Mennonites away from a longer traditional non-resistance to a just war position. That's exactly what state church thinks. Just war. That is how they justify war, because it's a just war. And there are qualifications that make a war either a just war or not. And that's what makes people have a willingness to support it, because it's a just war. So Benjamin Unruh says, "There is no contradiction between a good Christian in the Mennonite tradition and being a supporter of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi cause. If this man was so highly looked up to and he said that, that really moved the German Mennonites and Russian Mennonites to support Adolf Hitler and the Nazi cause." Have you ever never read in 1 Timothy 2:2, Adolf Hitler wants nothing for himself, everything only for his Volk. I honor him with my whole heart. I love him as one can only love a sovereign. Only history will reveal what God, through Adolf Hitler, has granted the German Volk in its entirety, including Germans in host countries, and what he will still grant to Europe and the world as well. Hitler is the great combatant of Stalin. He says to J. Siemens in January 1936, this is still before World War II, "We stand 100% with Adolf Hitler in his God-given calling to lead Germany out of chaos and thus also to support and protect Europe and the world against Bolshevik ruin." One must be a child not to see this. It's so obvious, he said. Okay, we got to take a break. So you stand, use the restroom, and come back and be seated here in about 5 or 7 minutes. So you may just take a break. Okay, I think we better reassemble so we can get finished in decent time. The picture you see on the screen right now is a rally in Canada. There are many German Mennonites who moved to Manitoba. And of course, they had relatives in Germany. And the Nazi ideas were exported out of Germany to Manitoba. Also, Paraguay was another place that Nazi ideas were exported to. And we'll talk more about that possibly later. But this is Canada. You see this picture. And by the way, while we're waiting for everybody to be seated, someone tell me what you see there inside that circle. What's that called? Swastika. All young people should know what that is. You don't mess around with that. If you think you're going to be cool and take a spray can and paint that on someplace as graffiti, you can get yourself into big trouble with the government today for that. Okay, we're going to move on. So some of you folks know the Holdman Mennonites. Okay, they have a church paper called The Messenger of Truth. On March 6, 1936, this was an editorial note in their Messenger of Truth. "Don't trust what the media says about Hitler. He's actually a great person. Look what he's done for the church, and look how other Mennonites love him. We need to have Dr. Benjamin H. Unruh's article translated in English for the benefit of all who don't know German. He's telling the true story. The European Mennonites wrote Hitler a telegram that deepened their relationship." Now, what's at the bottom there is just a note. In the 1930s, Mennonites around the world were excited to see the rise of Adolf Hitler. There had been much concerned talk of communism, liberalism, and immorality. Finally, God was putting their friend on the throne of power, and the wickedness of the world would be held in check. Now, below the title, "In Canada and the United States, the situation was similar. Although the Holdemans didn't participate in politics, the excitement about the godly German, Adolf Hitler, found its way into our church paper as well." A Holdeman is writing this to me. "High reviews were given to the works of the highly respected and well-known friend of the Russian Mennonites, Professor Benjamin H. Unruh, as a deeply intelligent man who wrote prolifically and made no secret of his love for Hitler. He boldly stated on at least one occasion, 'I am 100% for Hitler.'" Are we Swiss off the hook? The answer is no. You folks live here in Allen County. At Goshen, we have Goshen College. and Harold Bender worked at Goshen College. And Ori Miller was from the Goshen area, Forks Mennonite. When he got married, he moved to Pennsylvania. But listen, in 1944, Harold Bender commiserated with Ori Miller, MCC Executive Secretary, how all of us were greatly disturbed that we should be retaining Anru on our payroll while he was openly agitating against non-resistance. Our failure to repudiate Anru resulted in a magnification of his influence. Shortly thereafter, MCC Chair P.C. Hebert conceded that Brother B.H. Anru wholeheartedly supported the Nazi movement, and if MCC erred anywhere, it was in letting some support get to him when we already knew how he stood. So leaders knew where Benjamin Anru stood, and they still gave him a stipend. You can't talk out of both sides of your mouth. That's the Swiss Mennonites. That's my people. We were across the ocean. It didn't appear like we were supporting the Nazi cause. And now this whole thing has come out, and the Mennonite Quarterly Review did an entire issue trying to amend, apologize, repudiate any kind of support for this, but it's well past. It's just a huge embarrassment that the thing caught up with the Swiss as well. I think this is the April 2022 Mennonite Quarterly Review, where this is a part of the effort to correct that problem. Okay, so let me go to this picture first. Okay, this looks like Poland today on the both parts there. So the Nazis had discovered the Russian Mennonites, which were Germans. They saw how valuable these people were, and they wanted them back in Germany. They were some of the top of the line. I'm going to talk more about this shortly. And they had plans for putting them in Wartheland, that you see there in the dark red. Well, in order to get ready for all these Russian Mennonites coming back, they had to push Poles out of their properties to make a place for these people to live. Well, World War II ended and Germany lost. And so Wartheland's story never happened. But it was in the works. Let's go back. In 1944, under the legal guidance of Gustav Reimer and Benjamin Anru, Mennonites submitted articles of incorporation for the new Conference of Mennonite Congregations of German Nationality in the province of Wartheland, the new German resettlement area in conquered Poland. Now, here's the criteria. If you're going to live in Wartheland, it limited its membership to those of German nationality, strictly defined in Nazi Germany by blood and Volk, thus excluding Christians of Jewish or Slavic background. Now, here's what is so surprising. Our people, together with their spiritual leaders, would participate in the Nazi Party mourning celebration, which is a pagan activity, on one Sunday per month. Its purpose was to awaken and kindle forever anew the forces of instinct, of emotion, and of the soul, which are vital for the struggle for existence and the bearing of our people and our race for all times. That's hard for me to fathom. You mean German Mennonites would actually stoop to a pagan festival? One Sunday per month? I guess if you surrender the two kingdoms, you open yourself to anything. This is a quote from a book entitled Heidegger and the Will. This is also just hard for me to fathom. This is just breaking in. In such passages, Heidegger calls on students and others who to wholly submit to the will of Hitler, who is said to embody the will of the German people. His call demands a referral of one's will, offering it up in service of a greater will. The individual is called upon to authentically will by sacrificing his or her will to the one great will of the state, a will that is unified in the will of its fascist leader, Adolf Hitler. In these statements from Heidegger's political speeches, we find a call not simply to abandon one's will, but to actively defer it to the towering will of the Fuhrer. Now let me explain what that means. That means that every one of us sitting here, if Adolf Hitler was standing right here speaking, we all would say, we don't want anything but what you want, Hitler. Our wills are just your will. Can you imagine that? At one time, both Jews and Mennonites were welcomed by German princes who needed their tax money. Both groups aroused popular resentment and persecution because of their economic prosperity. Eventually, German political correctness showcased the prosperous Mennonites for their honesty and industry while declaring that the Jewish prosperity undermined German values. So Mennonites and Jews were on the same level in Germany. Now, Mennonites are going to be lifted and Jews are going to be put down. An old saying declared, you have to get up pretty early to hoodwink a Jew. But if you want to bamboozle a Mennonite, you can't even go to bed the night before. It indicates a similar kind of reputation between Jews and Mennonites. Said of German Mennonites in the 30s, this German mania, ethnic mania, transformed the public profile of Mennonites. The one-time pesky sect now epitomized Germanness with its steadfast adherence to thrift, sobriety, piety, honesty, and industry. Perhaps most significant was the Mennonite preservation of racial purity. No other German free church was lauded with such praise, and the Mennonites just basked in this praise. Now, let me explain what this is talking about. So when the Dutch people went from Holland or Netherlands to Prussia, the Prussian government tolerated them to be there. But they said, if you're here, if any of your people marry a non-Mennonite, the children of that marriage may not be baptized Mennonite. Well, parents want their children to be in the same faith they are. So that encouraged Mennonite to only marry Mennonite. And without even trying, they produced Aryans. And the Nazi says, look at the Mennonites. This is how you do it. These people have the top of the line. And the Mennonites just bask in the praise. Now remember, the Jews are being put down. The Mennonites are lifted up. Adolf Hitler spoke of Germany as a body, with himself as the doctor. He wanted to make Germany healthy by eliminating diseased, unhealthy parts of the body. Early on, this meant killing the disabled. I already showed you that. But because the Nazis also believed that Jews possessed bad genes, they too came to be portrayed by public health experts and scientists as a threat to racial purity and a healthy nation. How do you feel about that picture? Okay, one of the things I wanted my students to see before we go to Washington, D.C. is this film. This is one of the most effective propaganda pieces in modern times. I'm telling you, it's still outlawed in the country of France and some other countries probably. But it has now become legal in the United States. I've seen this. But I warn you, if you see this, it's about 45 minutes long. You might not like Jews till you're finished. It is so effective. Heinrich Himmler said, anti-Semitism is exactly the same as de-lousing. Getting rid of lice is not a matter of ideology. It's a matter of cleanliness. In just the same way, anti-Semitism for us has not been a question of ideology, but a matter of cleanliness. And so, Hitler required every German family to document its lineage back 5 generations and have the family records notarized. This thing of being Aryan was that important. The next is a quote from Manly Quarterly Review, April 2016. Genealogical Associations archived and cataloged large volumes of Mennonite ancestral information for determining whom to count Jewish versus Aryan. As a means of ensuring the collective Aryanness of Germany's Mennonite community, genealogical research was extremely effective. Individual members obligated to fill out racial passports were often able to do so with the help of church archivists or other local genealogists. At least one congregation met to fill out race forms as an official church activity. Instead of coming to prayer meeting, you came to document your Aryanness. One participant said, until now, a Mennonite was considered Aryan without question. A single case would ruin our reputation. So what are we talking about? This is the Mennonite Quarterly Review. If you're male, this is what you look like. And Jacob Peters, who is in our church, he's one of the pastors, is the only Mennonite we have, the pure Mennonite we have. And he looks like the second man there, to a certain extent. This is the Aryan that they're looking for. And here's the female. Here's more females. Racial scientists considered Mennonites to be unusually pure specimens of Aryanism. These 3 women lived in or near Danzig in 1931. They were integrated into racial studies before Hitler's rise to power. And Jacob Peters says, yep, he says, that's what our women look like. Aryans. Both males and females are prone to light hair, eyes, and skin. Of all Aryans, Mennonites were the tallest outside of Scandinavia. These are quotes from Chosen Nation. On the psychological side, Mennonites demonstrated simplicity, orderliness, diligence, integrity, detachment, stamina, but also stubbornness, insularity, and severity. Dutch Mennonites belong to the Friesian tribe, the oldest and noblest of all Germanic groups, whose racial character could be traced back for millennia. Okay, do any of you know anybody by the last name of Friesen? Okay, those people, Friesen, came from Friesland in Netherlands. They are some of the purest and best Aryans there are. Their character could be traced back for millennia. Mennonites, directly because of their Mennonite character, have been phenomenally productive, whether as pioneers of agriculture, as industrialists, as businessmen, or as tradespeople. Well, I live in Texas. You go across the border into Mexico, and you start driving down through the desert, and after a while you come to this prosperity just blooming out of the desert. Well, you just know there are Mennonites there. It's like they are so good at farming, they can grow corn out of rocks. It's like these people are industrious like you wouldn't believe. And they have skill like engineers like you wouldn't believe. And they don't have much education. It's like it's in their DNA. Phenomenal people. That's one of the reasons the Nazis liked them so much. The German Mennonites engaged in anti-Semitic communication. Get that. Mennonites engaged in anti-Semitic communication, both verbally and in print. They noted that Jews were part of the Bolshevik Revolution. Whew. In Russia. And profited financially from World War I. We could say a bunch of things there. I'm not going to say anything more at this point. They agreed that violence should not be used against Jews, but the legal restrictions were proper. This attitude was all the Nazis really needed to implement their final solution. The German Mennonites would be passive and silent as the Holocaust happened in their midst. In contrast, the Quakers corporately and individually refused to be passive and silent, actively aiding the Jews where and when they could. Many Mennonite survivors of the Stalinist terror and anti-Kulak and deportation campaigns expressed virulent hatred for both Jews and communists as equivalent evils. Okay, we could stand here and unpack that for a while, but I have something I want to special show you that will take care of that. Mennonites generally resented, envied, and despised Jews because so many of them seemed to have been found in the ranks of the Soviet secret police and Communist Party cadre, as well as among the supervisors and managers of collective farms and local government agencies. 40 to 50% of the secret police force in Russia were Jews. Okay, so there you have that. And I'm not going to take time, but I'm going to go to this picture. Okay, now this is a cartoon. On the right side, you see Karl Marx, who is the father of communism. You see Lenin in red. You see Trotsky, who is a Jew. And the lady that you see being sacrificed in that altar is Russia. They are sacrificing Russia to Marxism. And the various men here represent various people. The six people in white, excluding the lady who's being sacrificed, are all Jews. There were 12 people who met back in this little quote here. 12 persons who took part in this decisive gathering. There are 4 Russians, including Lenin, 1 Georgian, which was Stalin, 1 Pole, Dzerzhinsky, and 6 of them were Jews. It says in Russian, sacrifice to the international. You can just park and just look at that for a while. So why have the Jews been mistreated throughout history? They've been above average in intelligence. And other people have been jealous of them. And if you want people to stop being jealous of you, fail. But the Jews many times don't fail. They're so smart. Dennis Prager says, though, there's one more thing that is not included here. He says, the Jews throughout history have represented the moral law. And people are trying to forget God, are reminded of him, and they see Jews in Israel. And so get rid of them. So why do the Muslims want to get rid of Palestine? They don't like their morals. They don't like their religion. That's why they got to be gotten rid of. Big subject. Can't go any further there. Let's look at this list of people here. These are famous Jews. Albert Einstein was a Jew. Karl Marx, the father of communism, was a Jew. His right-hand man, Leon Trotsky, was a Jew that we saw in that picture. Henry Kissinger, U.S. Secretary of State, was a Jew. Sigmund Freud was a Jew, pioneer in psychoanalysis. Jonas Salk, the developer of polio vaccine, was a Jew. Mayor Rothschild, a financier, was a Jew. Jared Kushner, who is the president's son-in-law, is a Jew. Jews have held prominent places throughout history, and a lot of people don't like them. The Nazis used the cross and the Bible as they did their work. The Jews ended up crushed and dehumanized and all the more alienated because the symbols of redemption were used by their abusers. But drowning people abused by the life preserver turned to the safer worlds of agnosticism, atheism, or the vague, pluralistic, feel-good spiritualism, which is the position of most Jews today. We have some Orthodox Jews, but not really very many. Probably the only person who had any chance of hampering Hitler was the Pope, who had the ear of 40 million German Catholics, but he barely said a word. When German forces occupied Rome, he opened his sanctuary to give refuge to many thousands of non-Aryans, but he was committed to neutrality in the search for peace and feared provoking Hitler, so he opened not his mouth. the most harshly persecuted Christian group in Nazi Germany was the Jehovah's Witnesses. Of a population of 20,000, about half spent some time in concentration camps. At least 1,400 died in the camps, and about 250 were executed for refusing to bear arms. From 1920 to 1940, one-third of all Russian Mennonites men were arrested and disappeared. The Black Raven came at night, knocked on the door, took the father and husband away, and likely he was never seen again. The watching German Mennonites said, "The recently resurrected German Reich has become a protective bulwark against the Bolshevik assault. We remain spared from the horrors suffered by our comrades that share our faith and our racial stock in the Soviet Union. Praise God for Adolf Hitler. We're not under Stalin. We have Hitler. He's our savior." Because over in Russia, Stalin believed death is the solution to all problems. You don't solve problems, you kill the person. No man, no problem. That's how you solve it. Kill him. In 1937, Hitler ordered all German children into government schools. He said, "The youth of today is ever the people of tomorrow. For this reason, we have set before ourselves the task of inoculating our youth with the spirit of this community. At a very early age, at an age when human beings are still unperverted and therefore unspoiled, this Reich stands and is building itself up for the future upon its youth. And this new Reich will give its youth to no one, but will itself take youth and give to youth its own education and its own upbringing." Now here, Hitler had his head screwed on straight. He knew that the future is in the youth. And so you folks here at Allen County, I hope you are pouring all the energy you can into your young people. That is your future. I'm just delighted. I want to say this to all you young people who are sitting here tonight. You need to know this story. This is a preparation for you when you become older. These are quotes from Adolf Hitler. "He alone who owns the youth gains the future." He also said, "How fortunate for leaders that men do not think. It's always more difficult to fight against faith than against knowledge. Make the lie big. Make it simple. Keep saying it, and eventually they will believe it." Hitler said, "My educational method is hard. The weak must be chiseled away. In my order castles, young people will grow up who will frighten the world. I want a violent, arrogant, unafraid, cruel youth who must be able to suffer pain. Nothing weak or tender must be left in them. Their eyes must bespeak once again the free, magnificent beast of prey. I want my young people strong and beautiful. I shall train them in all kinds of athletics, for I want youth that are athletic. That's first and foremost. Thus I will face the pure and noble raw material. Thus I can create the new. I don't want an intellectual education. With knowledge I will spoil the young. I would vastly prefer them to learn only what they absorb voluntarily as they follow their play instinct. They shall learn to overcome the fear of death through the most arduous of tests. This is the historic stage of heroic youth." And so, we have the Hitler Youth. The boy turned 14. He could voluntarily join the Hitler Youth. Later on, it was mandatory. And then we have the German maidens. That's the girl side. This is a picture in Russia. This is Heinrich Himmler visiting Russian Mennonites who are Germans. Those girls you see, those are not head coverings, those are nurses' caps. But when Himmler went to Ukraine, he says, "I was in Ukraine and I looked the people over. Your Mennonites were the best," he said to Benjamin Unruh. And here is Hitler and Himmler. Hitler's on the left. Himmler is shaking his hand right there. The Nazis loved the Ukrainian Mennonites. That's why they wanted to create war with the land. They wanted to bring them closer to Germany. In fact, they cared so much about this that the Germans actually created a propaganda film targeting Russian Mennonites. I've seen this. This is so terrible, about makes the hair stand up in the back of your neck. You can still see this today. Red storm over the village or freezes in peril. Forget your non-resistance. It's outdated. We have something bigger and better. John F. Kennedy said, "The great enemy of the truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic." By 1937, Eberhard Arnold's German Hutterite community was forcibly dissolved because they opened their mouth and they criticized the Nazis, and the Nazis couldn't stand it. They said, "Get out!" And they made them leave Germany. But the Mennonites who stayed, to distance themselves from the Hutterites, the German Mennonites wrote, "Those Hutterites belong neither to the German Mennonite churches nor to any other organization within our free German Mennonite church. They are different from us." Adolf Hitler speaking to Danzig Mennonites. Now, a bunch of those are generals, and I don't know who is Mennonite and who is a general. In 1938, official church president Friedrich Werner gave orders that on Adolf Hitler's 49th birthday in April, all Protestant pastors must swear an oath of allegiance to the Führer and Reich Chancellor. Werner's decree included the words, "Anyone who refuses to take the oath is to be dismissed." The German Christians took the oath immediately with joyful hearts and in obedience to inner command. Once again, this is a basic principle for Anabaptists. You don't swear an oath. But they had a new master now, and they said, "Yes, sir." The confessing church was led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They felt that they had been ordered to break their ordination vow. The text that accompanied this oath described it as more than a recognition of duty to be subject to the governing authorities. It meant being in the most intimate solidarity with the Third Reich and with the man who created that community and embodies it. In other words, if you were an ordained man, you needed to place your loyalty to Hitler first. And so Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his companions traveled from one pastor's meeting to another to persuade ministers not to take the oath. But they had little success with their arguments. The whole matter became one of the most shameful defeats of the confessing church. Now, how many of you have read Eric Metaxas on Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Have you? One of you. Two of you. Then you know what I'm talking about. Here's what he looks like. I just admire this man who saw what was going on. The Mennonites couldn't see it, but he did. And he decided that he can't just simply go talk to the pastors. He said, in his own mind, "We have to do something about this." And so he joined with a group of people to kill Adolf Hitler. Now, that's a wrong way. But so he distanced himself from this. They eventually caught up with him. But they put a suitcase full of explosives with a timer right beside a table leg where Hitler was sitting, right there beside this leg. And the bomb was scheduled to go off at a certain time. Well, right before the bomb went off, Hitler got up and walked to some other part of the room. And it went off, killed some people, wounded a bunch of people, including Hitler. But Hitler was as mad as 10 hornet nests. And he ended up killing with a purge, I don't know how many people, just to get rid of all the people who might have conspired against him. They also got Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was hanged 2 weeks before liberation came. It didn't work. God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." I admire this man for not standing by passively, but I think he took a step too far. Okay, here's the oath that the soldiers needed to give. Every member of the armed forces, the Nazi military machine, was required to swear this oath. Now think, Mennonites are swearing this. I swear by God the sacred oath that I will render unconditional obedience to Adolf Hitler, the Führer of the German Reich, Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, and that I shall at all times be prepared as a brave soldier to give my life for this oath. He had a new Savior. I couldn't do that. I don't think you could either. So official German military publications supported the Third Reich, praised the Nazi armies, rejoiced in their victories, and called for Mennonites to lay down their lives for their friends. With the 1939 reunion of Danzig with Germany, the Prussian Mennonites praised the act as nothing short of the mercy and will of God. But in a few years, the victories crumbled into ashes and bitter tears. This is Danzig in 1945, just one bombed out place. They were praising God for Adolf Hitler, sparing them from Russia, Stalin, and look at their city. Until it ceased publication in 1941, the German Mennonite periodical blah, 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 continued to laud Hitler and his policies as well as to provide theological and biblical reasons for supporting them. Hitler says in 1941, I can't break the church over my knee. It has to be left to rot like a gangrenous limb. But the healthy youth belong to us. He says, we shall not rest. This is Heinrich Himmler now, not Hitler. We shall not rest until we have rooted out Christianity. When the Nazis permitted the German Mennonites freedom to exist as a church only if they abandoned all critical public commentary. In other words, you don't say anything against the Nazis. They said, yes, sir. They had no anchor. And so, not one able-bodied Mennonite man of draft age in all of Germany refused conscription. There was not one conscientious objector. Some even joined the notorious SS. And here's one man. I've got to talk to you about this man. This picture is in this book. This is Heinrich Wiens. To his credit, he laid his membership aside for 1 year before he started this, but he had one of these, a mobile gas van. It's a mobile Jewish killing unit. Here's another picture like one. So what he would do, he would go to a Polish Jewish village, and he would tell the Jews, all right, you have 1 week to register. Next week, this time, you are all here with some of your belongings. You're going to be transported. They didn't say where. You just need to be ready to go. So 1 week later, Heinrich Wiens would show up with, and his men with a truck. And they would haul these Jews outside of town, and then they would say, all right, first 25, close off, in that truck. And if you didn't listen, there was men standing there with guns that would shoot you if you didn't do this. So they get 25 in here, they close the doors, drive up through the field, turn the gas on, which is the exhaust, and until everybody's dead, they come back, they tell the living Jews, all right, dead out into the pit. Next 25, close off, get in. So they did it. They kept redoing that until every Jew in the village was killed. Then they would go to the next Jewish village and do the same thing. And then the next Jewish village and do the same thing. Do you have any idea why they told them to take their clothes off? Well, I've got to close out here before too long. It's because they're very practical. It not only dehumanized them, but they're going to reuse these clothes. And it's easier to get living people to take their own clothes off than it is to take the clothes off of dead people. If you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., you see tables where they put corpses. They opened the corpse's mouth and dug the gold out of their teeth. They would cut all the ladies' hair off before they would gas them because they had mountains of hair, female hair. They're going to use it for upholstery. Mountains of shoes. While the public face of German Mennonites consistently supported the Nazi regime, this was not a result of cold calculation. Neither did it take place in the absence of soul searching. Nevertheless, their faith failed to provide a perspective that transcended the trappings of their culture and their era. And an example is this picture. This is a place for Ruth. This book right here. These are her parents. That's Johannes, and he was a member of the SS. His job was to guard, and I don't know what he guarded. But Goethe, his wife, whenever the Russians were pushing the German Nazis back into Germany, she had to flee. She took her children. Here you can see them. Ruth is on the top right. She took her children and fled to the North Sea. They're trying to get to Denmark. She got on this barge, and you know barges kind of bob in the water like this. She took a sheet along. And she said, we're all going to live or we're all going to die together. So she put a sheet around herself and put all her children inside that sheet. And believe it or not, they actually made it to Denmark. The barge right beside them hit a mine and exploded. And believe it or not, this entire family was reunited after the war, except for Grandma. And I'm going to tell you about Grandma here shortly. A remarkable story right here. The biggest flaw of the Mennonites was not any immediate error. Instead, it was a natural consequence of years of gradual theological adaptation and compromise to better fit with the German community. The consequences for the German Mennonites of abandoning their New Testament principles was complicity with the Nazi regime and being collaborators in the Jewish Holocaust. Okay, at the end of World War II, when the Soviets began to push the Nazis back into Germany. It says in early 1945, the Mennonites of the former West Prussia were the hapless victims of the advancing Russian army. The general fear of being caught by the invaders led many to flee to the West. That's what Goethe did with her family, get up to Denmark. Those who remained or waited too long to escape, usually the sick, the young, and the elderly. That was Grandma in that picture. She did not flee. They suffered mightily at the hands of the Russian army. Starvation, and get this, Soviets are known for this. The Soviets raped every woman they could find. Probably happened to Grandma. Bodily injury, torture, deportation to Russia, the loss of life were among the horrific events of those days. Congregations and families were torn apart. Most would never see their homeland again. The vibrant communities of Mennonites in West Prussia were utterly destroyed. Their 400-year home was gone. Rather than having their insecure fears of being expelled from Germany by the Nazis realized, the Prussian Mennonites found a much worse fate at the hands of the advancing Soviet army. By the summer of 1945, the Prussian Mennonites lost their 400-year home in the region. Think about this. There's what's left. Graves. After the Nazi atrocity became fully known to the public in 1945, the Mennonites found themselves battling the demon of their own creation in the stark realization of having compromised their fundamental tenets of faith by their allegiance with one of the most evil regimes in human history. How in the world did that happen? A little bit at a time. It took 30 years before writings addressing the Nazi past came to be written. And for many, this was a very painful process. And I have more to say about that later. But I would like to look at the next part. You go to Washington, D.C., you can look at a map. They have a map where they had all their concentration camps. The first concentration camp built outside of Germany was built among the Mennonites at Stutthof in Mennonite territory. It was located east of Danzig in the midst of Mennonite farmhouses. A large number of smaller camps belong to this KZ. And the inhabitants of the area often stall starving prisoners on their stripe, in their striped dress on their way to the places of their forced labor. Mennonites used slaves to work for them as a part of their participation in this whole thing. This is a Mennonite man's office. His name is Epp. You can see his picture in this book. He had a business that he used concentration camp inmates. Here's what the concentration camp looked like. About 65,000 people died of starvation, overwork, and epidemics and brutality and murder at Stutthof. And look at this. They had some female guards stand at Stutthof. And you see these two girls, Elizabeth Becker and Jenna Wanda Barkman. Now, I don't know for sure, but both of those are Mennonite names. I don't know if they're Mennonites at this time or not. They're standing trial after the war. Did they look very sorry? Well, this is Jenny Wanda Barkman, Stutthof female guard, executed by hanging on July 4, 1946. There is a 97-year-old former secretary of the Stutthof camp. She was brought to justice in 2021, just 5 years ago, charged with more than 11,412 counts. She's died now. In the meantime, they didn't kill her. She just died. And here's another book entitled Mennonites and Nazi. This picture is in the book here. This is a Mennonite church house in Paraguay with Hitler's picture above the pulpit. The banner says, communal benefit before personal benefit. So we could raise the question, why did this happen? Well, Adolf Hitler provided religious direction. Number two, he improves a farming economy. Number three, he created a strong central government. Number four, he worked to destroy communism. Number five, he offered hope to discourage Germany. Like our brother said, they could eat ice cream again. He offered a comprehensive solution to German problems. We look back at this time in history and are perplexed. Couldn't the German people understand what was happening? Didn't a constant diet of slanted media raise any concerns? Incredibly, few were aware of how their views and values were being shaped because it was accomplished through entertainment. They laughed together at the comedies, cried together through emotional scenes, and rejoiced together when German heroes conquered. These movies were the talk on the street the next day. They couldn't wait for the next new film. But unknown to the public, they were allowing media to change their views, their values, and the very core of who they were, their philosophic center. And here is the first official Mennonite acknowledgement, 50 years later. Quote, most Mennonites in Germany gave in to the temptation of Nazism and sacrificed a peace witness. Very often they valued their commitment to the state higher than their duties to Mennonite brothers and sisters in the Netherlands and France. And I didn't tell you anything about that. We have German soldiers fighting against German Mennonite soldiers fighting against French and Belgian Mennonites. So we have Mennonite fighting Mennonite in World War II. Nearly all the Mennonites remain silent in the face of the Nazi crimes against Jews and others. We can only plead for forgiveness with the words of the Lord's Prayer. Brothers and sisters, first, we overlook evil. Then we permit evil. Then we legalize evil. Then we promote evil. Then we celebrate evil. And then we persecute those who still call it evil. That's profound. The truth has no defense against a fool determined to believe a lie, Mark Twain said. And I'll just skip over this. And really what's sad, this is said of a former Mennonite Nazi in 2001. That's only 25 years ago. The majority have not recognized the need for repentance of any kind. There are many. If there's any of these people still living today, it's a good chance they still love Hitler. The Mennonite open-mindedness toward the Third Reich was possible when the Mennonites left the early separation, two-kingdom principle, and integrated into Prussian Protestant society. This pattern has not changed since 1945. It's like, they still didn't get it. Why did German Mennonites become Nazis? They were the heirs of groups who, after long centuries of being disadvantaged, had now made tremendous gains and had flourished quickly after adapting to German society. They had long since lost any connection to the critical stance of the first Anabaptists, and their understanding of their own history was revisionist. They adopted the predominant Protestant theology of Lutheranism, according to which the head of state is acting as God's instrument, although there were also some dissent. In general, however, German Mennonites of this time separated their personal religious beliefs from their political opinions. There is no denying. Simon Wiesenthal, who wrote the book The Sunflower, said this: there is no denying, this is a metaphoric statement, there is no denying that Hitler and Stalin are alive today. They are waiting for us to forget, because that's what makes it possible for the resurrection of these monsters. Non-cooperation with evil is every bit of moral obligation as cooperation with good. Evil prospers when good men do nothing about it. Oh God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the storming blast, and our eternal home. There is the place for Ruth and a Mennonite German soldier. There is what the chosen nation looks like, European Mennonites and the Holocaust. And I didn't mention this book. This is a wonderful book, but I better not talk about it now. You're barely keeping your eyes open. So thank you for staying with me. I know it's a long time, but thank you for your good attendance. And I hope the children have comfortable dreams. They don't have nightmares. And I guess it's your choice to how long you want to stay, but we're way over time. But even so, is there anybody who has any questions before we close out? Yes.
I have one. How did they get the hate that's stirred up to the Jews in their propaganda? How did they, what was the beginning of that? How did they do that? That's a
long. Some of it has to do with Hitler's personal feelings, and I don't know what all the story as to why he developed a hatred for Jewish people. But he was able, with other people who hated Jews, and they developed and got a propaganda machine going that all of Germany eventually hated Jews. And it's just an amazing story how they got that accomplished. How do you convince an entire nation to hate one group of people? Good question. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, is that possible? Just they were, one man can influence a lot of people, right? So influence is a big thing. And it happens in the spiritual world also when we're divinely influenced. So we walk differently and we think differently. And one other thought I had amongst all this as I was going through this, I wonder how many people thought about when we hold up political men, so to speak. And I know, you know, this, I don't want to talk about it. I'm not into politics that much, but I know I hear it, you know, our current president, how people laud him, half hate him and half love him, and still political. And it's, I would say it's a danger to latch on to the, and get too involved in a kingdom that's not of God or it's not of Christ. Anything that's of the other kingdom, I think we should be very, very cautious how much we get involved in it. The more we get involved, the more influence we'll be. And so, yeah, I just thought of that. And then a couple other things that run through my mind is, through it all, this whole thing, there's a lot of promises in the Bible, and one of the pure in heart, and an honest heart won't believe a lot of lies. And I don't know how many people knew this, but many years ago before I was converted, a man came to my house and he asked me, is there any questions? He was selling Bible books. And I told him, yeah, I have a question. I was living in sin, so I was deeply concerned about where I was, but I didn't have any answers. And I asked him, is there a hell? And he said, no. And my heart leapt for joy. There's one great burden in my heart. Make sure our joy that we have today is not believing in lies. And the Spirit of God can clearly define the two kingdoms clearly. The Holy Spirit is light, and it is a teacher. It will direct our way if we're honest. But if we want to believe a lie and we want to love this world, the kingdom of this world, then, yeah, we have that choice. And we can believe lies and let our heart leap for joy. Protestants believe in a lot of wrong ideas in their gospel that they present. And we need to be clear of that, because that alone, starting to take in wrong ideas, can lead to... I just believe that these people here did not start out just, you know, like you said, it was in increments. It took time for them to come to this. But I believe they were outside the kingdom long before they took and participated in believing in this guy here. I'm talking about Hitler. And believed in him and showed their loyalty to him. I think prosperity and who knows what. I don't know really too much about their prosperity, but there's a lot of things can take our heart away from truth. So I will just leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, brother. There's much I could comment on. I just thank you. That's enough. We got to get home and get to bed. Anybody else? Okay. If not, you folks are very good. You're staying with me. Nobody's sleeping. So there are better places to sleep than here. So find your beds. Thank you for your attention. I'll give it back to whoever.